This year, NPR is celebrating the teaching profession with a series called 50 Great Teachers. And our movie critic Bob Mondello couldn't resist. He offers this look at what Hollywood has taught him about teaching.
Will everyone please try to find a seat?
Teachers are a type in Hollywood as bound by convention as the guys who wear white hats in Westerns. They're mostly young, they're always energetic, and they answer to honorifics.
Mr. Chips.
Miss Brody.
Miss Moffat.
Mr. Miyagi.
Or just plain...
Sir or Mr. Thackeray.
Sir with love, of course. Also, if need be...
Hey, what's up, teach?
If that's what it takes to get their students to stand and deliver, to be great debaters, or to form dead poet societies while heading up the down staircase in a blackboard jungle. You know the type. Hardworking, earnest, and most of all, inspirational. All while confronting, because Hollywood never does anything halfway, the sort of challenge that would give pause to a miracle worker. The miracle workers, Annie Sullivan, for instance, had to get through to a kicking, biting, almost feral Helen Keller, who had been deaf and blind since infancy. With only a few gestures to signal what she wants, 7-year-old Helen has no way to communicate with those around her, and initially no concept of language itself. Her breakthrough comes in what amounts to a ferocious battle with Annie at a backyard water pump, where she suddenly realizes that the motions her teacher's been making in the palm of her hand connect to the movement of Annie's lips.
W-A-T-E-R, water. It has a name. W-A-T.
And that they symbolize an idea, the wetness she's feeling. She mimics Annie's hand movements, spelling it back.
Yes. Oh, my dear.
And immediately, Helen wants other words, pounding on the earth beneath her feet.
Round.
Annie spells it out, and Helen spells it back.
Yes.
And as powerfully as it ever has on film, a whole world of knowledge opens up. Most on-screen teachers confront more conventional students and forge bonds with them over more conventional problems, kids who don't think they want to learn, who mistrust authority, who are bored, and who inspire teachers like Robin Williams in Dead Poets Society to find unorthodox ways to enliven classwork.
I stand upon my desk to remind myself that we must constantly look at things in a different way. See, the world looks very different from up here. You don't believe me? Come see for yourselves. Come on. Come on. Even though it may seem silly or wrong...
This gets him in trouble with the headmaster, and that's pretty much a standard Hollywood plot development. Teachers who care, and you wouldn't make a film about them if they didn't, must not only relate to students, but must also shield them from their own parents, from school administrators, from the police, and from social forces that lead them to not value education in the first place. Stand and Deliver's math teacher, Jaime Escalante, for instance, helping Latino students to overcome, first, their own resistance to authority...
Discuss sex, I have to give sex for homework.
And then when they start to succeed, he helps them overcome the unfair perceptions of administrators wielding standardized tests. Denzel Washington is up against even stronger forces in The Great Debaters, a film set in the segregated South of 1935. When his black college debate team is told it cannot compete in a national tournament, he lets them know his stake in their struggle is personal.
You are my students. I am your teacher. I think that's a sacred trust. So what do I say to you now? Quit? Because the dean says so? Because the sheriff says so? Because the Texas Rangers say so? No. I am diametrically opposed to that. My message to you is to never quit.
We are not quitting.
Good.
The rebel with a class, as it were, is a relatively recent development in Hollywood. On-screen teachers were long pictured in gentler terms as protective and nurturing rather than crusading. Movies tended to subscribe to the King and I's true but sappy thought that if you become a teacher, by your pupils you'll be taught.
As a teacher, I've been learning. You forgive me if I boast. And I've now become an expert on the subject I like most. Getting to know you. getting to know.
No tough assignments in her class. But the year that movie came out, the rougher side of that getting to know students equation was already on display in Blackboard Jungle, set in an inner city school where teacher Glenn Ford sparred with rebellious student Sidney Poitier.
There was no racial issue till you made one.
Why, you got the knife out for me.
Oh, man, there's a real switch. I mean, after all the trouble you caused...
Boy, you really got it bad.
You deny it!
You gonna hit me? I'd really like that. That'll really wash you up around here.
A few years later, teacher Poitier got his comeuppance in To Sir With Love.
I lost my temper. The one thing I swore I would never, never do. Those kids are devils. Nothing I tried.
Kids.
What?
Kids. That's it.
And that became the new template, teachers wading into issues of race, class, generational conflict to help kids with good intentions and reliably conventional wisdom. More recently, the wisdom's been less conventional, say in the comedy School of Rock, where the teacher is almost inadvertently successful at winning over his charges.
If you want to rock, you gotta get mad at the man. And right now I'm the man. And who's got the guts to tell me off? Huh?
You're a joke. You're the worst teacher I've ever had.
Summer, that is great. I like the delivery because I felt your anger.
Thank you.
A tougher approach to music instruction is this year's Whiplash, where the jazz instructor seems fine until his auditioning drummer gets the tempo wrong.
Why do you suppose I just hurled a chair at your head, Neiman?
The tempo?
Were you rushing or were you dragging?
I don't know.
Start counting.
One, two, three, four. One, two, three, four. One, two, three, four.
Now, was I rushing or was I dragging?
Oh, no.
Count again.
One, two, three, four. One, two, three, four. One, two, three,
rushing
four.
Rushing or dragging?
Rushing.
So you do know the difference!
Inspiration through fear, a definite outlier. Far more frequently, movies reinforce the notion that in secular society, teaching is the closest thing we have to a religious vocation. You don't decide to teach, you're called to teaching as a profession. And as with religion, this calling is one in which the basic job hasn't changed in 1,000 years. You stand in front of your flock, which expects you to be above reproach, both on and off the job. Your authority comes from on high. You need the patience of a saint, the wisdom of a rabbi, and the endurance of a martyr. And at day's end, the rewards are largely spiritual. As when Helen Keller, having pretty much worn out Annie Sullivan, demanding the name of every object around them, finally points to Annie herself. And Annie, choking back tears, spells out T-E-A-C-H-E-R. And Helen spells it back. And the lesson begins. I'm Bob Mandela.
Every year, hundreds of hikers take on the grueling Pacific Crest Trail over the Sierra Nevada and Cascade Mountains. This adventure is not easy. The new movie Wild, which opened this past week, shows what the months-long journey can be like. Reporter Lisa Morehouse visited the trail last summer and talked to hikers who had finished the whole 2,650 miles of it. And she found that the only thing they talk about more than their aching feet is food. They have to carry it all, except when they get surprised by a little trail magic.
At a really beautiful but tough, steep patch of the Pacific Crest Trail near the Sonora Pass in California, a slight blonde woman in a cowboy hat carries a huge backpack. Her name is Shannon Pepper.
A.K.A. Pan from Missoula, Montana. Saying hard times ain't gonna rule my mind, sugar.
Pan's been hiking for more than 2 months.
When you're on trail and you're carrying all of your own meals, it can get really scary when you are close to being out. And I feel like I have a little better perspective on what it really means to be hungry. And you live in a society of plenty, and there isn't plenty when you have to carry all of it.
Your whole herd.
But plenty is what Pan finds when she walks into a picnic area where Hank Magnuski, trail named The Owl, has set up the Sonora Pass Cafe.
I'm The Owl. I'm your host here.
Oh, wonderful.
Help yourself.
Magnuski smiles as he brews up gourmet coffee on a portable stove.
Folks are doing 25 miles a day. It's like a marathon every single day for 6 months. And Trail Magic helps alleviate the pain.
Trail Magic. That's any serendipitous help offered to hikers. Water or free rides or hiker-friendly food. Magnuski's actually a Silicon Valley engineer, but he's volunteered on a trail crew at the Sonora Pass for years. He realized how barren it is, even this picnic area.
There's nothing here but trees and a privy. The thought of a full-blown cafe in the middle of the wilderness just seemed like a neat idea.
So about a decade ago, he started setting up the Sonora Pass Cafe a few weekends each season. Today, Pan and other hikers with trail names like Gotta Walk, Pesky, and Laugh Track gather around.
Gotta do what you're told.
This is a crazy surprise. Yeah.
We have the classic, beautiful, like, fresh fruit.
He's got delicious beer.
There's a chocolate cake that you can't even imagine on the trail.
Also Wi-Fi. So currently I'm blogging.
Here comes the cookie.
Kat Addison, trail name Cat Dog, is from Bend, Oregon. She hasn't come down off the trail to rest or replenish her pack in 9 days.
When I got to the trailhead on the other side, I saw this little sign that there was trail magic. I started to cry because I was so tired. So I'm so glad to be here.
Addison's 62, and she's through hiking the trail for the first time.
The Sierras have kicked me around a little bit. I mean, I've had a couple meltdowns, a couple face plants. Didn't feel too good. People always say the trail provides, and sometimes it does.
Trail Here's magic.
The
trail
Here's to Hank's Sonora Cafe trail magic.
Hooray. Now, there's color in the cheeks and light in the eyes of the hikers as they throw on their packs and head out for a few more hours on the trail.
Congratulations on that 1,000 miles.
For NPR News, I'm Lisa Morehouse at the Sonora Pass.
And it's all downhill from there.
To the Columbia River?
To the Columbia River, that's right.
Last night, NBC took a chance with some pixie dust and live TV.
I'm flying.
Flying, flying.
Over bed, over chair, duck your head, clear the air.
Peter Pan Live was a new 3-hour presentation of the musical, which first debuted on TV in 1955. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans stayed up to watch it and is here to talk about how it went. Hey there, Eric.
Hey.
So Peter Pan was played by Allison Williams, who co-stars on the HBO show Girls. Christopher Walken was Captain Hook. How did they do?
Well, first, let's note this was a really ambitious effort. I think Williams was full of energy as the boy who never grew up. She has a great singing voice, and she did a pretty good job of nailing that British accent. But Walken was so laid back as Captain Hook, he seemed to be sleepwalking through a lot of this production. Let's listen to how he sounded during one of the numbers.
Listen to your peerless leader. Once I get me Hook in Peter, life will go from sweet to sweeter, I say.
A little loungy. Actor Josh Molina tweeted, I can't believe Christopher Walken is up this late. You know, Eric, NBC's Sound of Music Live got so much criticism online last year. People talked about hate watching it, right? Watching it just to complain. Did that happen with Peter Pan?
Well, I was trading a lot of messages and live tweeting myself last night, and there were lots of people cracking jokes about it online. But I coined a new term for watching this production, which was bored watching.
Okay.
Despite special effects like a computer-generated Tinkerbell and some great production numbers, the two leads just weren't charismatic enough to command that stage. And that 3-hour length was like an endurance test. So by the midpoint, people were posting all kinds of odd jokes. And by the end, I saw this post from an account named @sloganagain. And they said, next year, they should just give Meryl Streep a bottle of vodka and the script to Oklahoma and see what she does.
I would watch that. All right. right. Mixed reviews at best. How did it do in the ratings?
Well, NBC has preliminary ratings that show about 9.1 million people watched it live Thursday night, which is about half the night of viewership of The Sound of Music from the year before. And now that's still great Thursday ratings for NBC. And given that The Wall Street Journal reported the network earned up to $400,000 per 30-second advertisement, that's a pretty good sign that they might want to try it again. NBC seems to be trying to build an audience for live musicals that's partly people who love this stuff and partly people who watch to make fun of it. And as long as they get a healthy rating from those two groups, I don't think they really care all that much why people are watching it.
That's NPR's TV critic Eric Deggans doing the tough work for us, the endurance test. Eric, thanks so much.
Always a pleasure.
Aaron Permort was best remembered as a mild-mannered art director by day, crime-fighting superhero by night. He was, in fact, Spider-Man. At least that's what Permort and his wife Nora would have you believe. Together, they wrote Mr. Permort's obituary that ran this week in the Minneapolis Star Tribune. And Nora McInerney, Permort, joins me to explain. Welcome to the program, and first of all, we're, of course, so very sorry for your loss.
Thanks, Melissa.
Would you mind reading for us the first line of the obituary that you wrote with your husband?
Yeah, sure. Permort Aaron Joseph, age 35, died peacefully at home on November 25th after complications from a radioactive spider bite that led to years of crime fighting and a years-long battle with a nefarious criminal named Cancer, who has plagued our society for far too long.
Hmm. Now, how did you, with your husband, decide to write that?
Aaron was a huge Spider-Man fan, a big nerd, and he had this beautiful, sparkling sense of humor his entire life, and his illness didn't fade that at all. So we had a pretty, I guess, irreverent sense of humor, and we joked around a lot, like, throughout his sickness. And, he called his, chemo pills, chemo grigio. He just, had all these, funny jokes. And when he was given, the hospice option that day, we went home, and we'd been really good at kind of taking care of, all the business and clerical aspects of being sick. So that we wouldn't have to spend, the last most important parts of his life going through that. But we had never written the obituary. So we sat up that night and we laughed so hard, and we were just, this big pile of tears and snot. And this is what we came up with.
I've been looking through the blog that you've been keeping through your husband's illness. He had brain cancer. It's called My Husband's Tumor. And you say there, it's not a cancer story, it's a love story with some cancer.
Yeah.
And you're very, very open throughout the blog about what was going on and the progress of his illness. How did you decide to start writing about that?
I have always been a writer, and this happened and just nothing slowed down. So I'd started the Tumblr, and it was set private. There was a password on it and nobody could read it. It was really just for, Aaron and myself. And then I thought, well, okay, maybe this will be a way to keep, our friends and family updated so I won't have to send so many text messages about it. And then it just kind of became something else. And it really was, to me, the best way that I could honor this wonderful love that I found. And I think we all, the reasons that you love somebody are so mysterious. Love is the biggest mystery in the world. And yet I've just been spending the past 3 years trying to articulate why this guy specifically was so special and so special to me. After a while, this is the chronicle of our love story. It's wonderful. I want it to be out there. There's no reason to keep it to myself.
Nora, I want to ask you about the very end of the obituary that you and your husband wrote together. Mm-hmm. And it says that Aaron is survived by his parents, his sisters, his first wife, Gwen Stefani, the singer.
Yes, she's been very quiet about the whole thing, very brave.
Yeah. His current wife, Nora, and their son, Ralph. And you wrote this, who will grow up to avenge his father's untimely death.
No pressure.
How old is Ralph?
He'll be 2 in January.
Mm.
So by that, we didn't mean he has to grow up and become an oncologist, although I would be very proud. But just, life is the best way to avenge it. I want that boy to grow up to be as much of a man as his father was. Aaron was so kind and gentle, and he was really, really nice all the time to everyone. And, like, I can see that in our son, and he could too, so...
Well, Nora, again, we are so sorry for your loss, and thank you for taking time to talk to us.
No, thanks for letting me talk about the best thing in the world.
That's Nora McInerney Permort. She and her husband Aaron wrote his obituary before he died last week at age 35, revealing his super secret identity. He was Spider-Man.